Hello, hello. This is Kinnack with the 14th Metroplexity podcast, September 2010, from those of you listening from the future. But we're going to be talking about a bit of stuff with the unearthly item rotation, the sewer hideout revamp, and then going on to a whole slew of questions varying from usual game design and setting stuff to apparently some questions about my, you know, sexual proclivities. So we'll see how that goes. Let's get the party started. I've got a little bit I want to say about the unearthly item rotation. I think everybody's clear now on how that'll work, when that will happen, and what items will stay and go. So when I release September's unearthly item, which will be in the next few days, probably not Sunday's rollover, but like Mondays or Tuesdays, you will get a, you know, September's item, and then the last four other ones, you know, like the back to the cloak, and then the an older one, which in this case is the puzzle box, and you'll have that, and the items that you retrieve from Zach at the beginning of the run will just be the ones that match up with his list. Okay, so everybody's on the same page there. Good. And that will continue to be updated every time that a new unearthly item is released. And that solves sort of multiple goals, which, if anybody wants to talk about at some point, I can, but we'll assume that everybody's on the same page now, because we've talked about this pretty much endlessly. The part about it that I kind of want to touch on a little more is the seasonal reset board. And I say seasonal very specifically because monthly is a filthy, filthy lie, right? It's whenever a new unearthly item is introduced and that rotation triggers, a new season starts. And here's how that's going to work. As long as you use Zach within one season, you'll be listed as being in that season for the leaderboards, right? So from when I release the next unearthly item to when I release the one after that, right? You'll be in season one, and then it's season two, season three, so on and so forth. So as long as, you know, you retrieve your items from Zach, and if you want to buy anything in run from Zach, you do that completely within season one, you're fine. You'll be listed on season one boards, even if your run doesn't end until we're in season two. If you do a completely earthly run, like you don't do anything with Zach, it'll just show up in whichever board the run ended during. So I think that all kind of follows. If you try to get around it and use unearthly items for multiple seasons, you won't be listed in either, is the way that ends up working. So I guess, like, I'm sure there will be a bug at some point that'll let you do that, but it is definitely a bug. All of the runs, regardless of any of the seasonal stuff, will still show up, you know, in the survivors board, like, you know, just a normal survivors reset board. The only other thing that jumps out that I should mention is that, unlike the survivors reset runs that are reset to reset, right, the ones for the seasonal boards are from when you start the new run until you qualify for a new reset, so until you've finished the main quest line, right? So you'll go from the beginning of Southside Park quest to the end of the Survivor's quest, and then you're done and it's recorded, right? So that means, you know, you can take time at the end of the run and it doesn't, you know, screw up your numbers or anything like that. For the Kingdom of the Lonely People, the run ends when you break the prism, not when you ascend. I might have just lost the term that King Will uses for that, which is fine. And not when you reset again. I want to say ascend, right? Yeah, ascension, yeah, okay. Okay, so If anybody has any more questions about that, or if I've made that any more confusing, I can answer them. But suffice to say, I think it works out pretty well. Zach will warn you if you try to do anything that would stick you in two different seasons at the same time, therefore, you know, booching the run, so to speak. And he'll you'll still be able to do it, obviously, but he'll tell you. And that's, I think, pretty much all I wanted to say about that. So for normal rational runs where you're not trying to screw with anything, they'll be listed in the season of whenever you're using Zach in that run. If you are in a run that doesn't have anything to do with Zach, it'll just be when you finish. So I think we're good. Hopefully we're all clear on that. It's not, I don't think it's anything too weird or confusing, but I leave that up to to your interpretations. The Sewer Hideout revamp, wanted to just touch on that. I went through and completely gutted the Sewer Hideout and rebuilt it from scratch. And that was basically to allow for ways to go through the quest without just, you know, slaughtering every man, and other slightly bigger man in the fortress, in the Sewer Hideout, rather. And so that's all. That all works more or less the same if you want to take the violent route. But if you want to take non-violent route, there's a couple ways to do that now, which is pretty cool. Some of the choice adventures effects changed a little bit to match up with that, and a couple of other suggestions that people had. But for the most part, it was just adding in those alternate ways. I ended up scrubbing it just because the choice adventures, adding in all of the stealthy sneaky options, would have made them really bloated. So you'd end up having, like, you know, 5-6 options, which always feels really inelegant to me. So just rebuilt it from scratch instead, which seemed to work out fine. I haven't gotten a ton of feedback about that yet, so I assume that it's mostly working, but that most people haven't touched it yet, which is fine. Let's see. So those are the two big things I want to talk about. We can get on to questions here. First, we've got a batch from Meg. Is there something important we haven't discovered about the spear gun? No. Well, rest of the question. It seems like it should be the go-to weapon for underwater ranged combat, but using a regular gun with more range power seems to work much better. I need to go in and give it a technique. I have the arc for it and everything. That area has a technique density unrivaled anywhere else in the game. Not that I think most of them have found yet, but there are a lot of techniques there. And I was kind of like, oh god, there's so many techniques here, I need to, you know, not have so many techniques. And spear gun hit the cutting floor, and it really shouldn't have. And I just need to go back in and add it. I'll mention in the dev blog when I do, but it'll be really easy to find, probably, unless I have some bizarre idea of how to unlock it. As far as I can tell, the fastest way through Hell's part of the Survivor's Quest is also the easiest. Blunder around the buried lab until the Revolty takes notice and issues the Omega Order. Is there some benefit we haven't found yet to keeping the lab around, or is that something that will only become important later when more content goes in? Hell's kind of a blunt instrument sort of person. And I think the quest kind of reflects that, which is about half of what the survivors' quests are supposed to do, sort of reflect each of their personalities. Because you have to choose at the end which of them you're going to be working with for the rest of the main quest line. Which is something that I'd like for you to have that knowledge going in. There are some fringe benefits of keeping the lab open for a bit, but nothing stunning. There's some stuff that might show up, some side effects of stuff that Thrivaldi may say to his superiors, that sort of thing. That may show up later, but for the most part, really, you know, killing them all and letting Botan sorts them out, is kind of the Hell's preferred route through quests, so it's a little supposed to be like that. A little while ago, you posted in response to the point that there are apparently no skill that goes plus 2 stealth power. It is kind of weird that the Shadowy Presence grants self-defense rather than stealth power. Should I parse that as, maybe I should change what that skill does, or, so you noticed that, did you? Maybe you should spade some more. No, more the former. I don't think I'm going to change it. I think I'm going to add a different skill. It would be really easy to change, so it's kind of tempting. Maybe I could add another skill off that. Branches. I guess we'll see. But the as it stands, I kind of like that there's a skill that grants stealth defense. And now the gears are turning, but I won't make you listen to the gears turn. But I like that there's a skill that grants stealth defense. Because there aren't many places to get that. I would also like for there to be a skill that grants stealth power to kind of finish that that symmetry. Whether that shows up being inserted, you know, sort of back in one of the previous quests, or is something that shows up in future content, could go either way. What does the image for the brutality technique represent? It's basically a guy getting curb stomped, not literally curb stomped, which, as a side note, is not a combat maneuver for the faint of heart, if you're not familiar with the actual etymology of that phrase. But if you look at the upper right, there's a leg coming down. I will grant that it's kind of hard to parse out, like, who or what he is curb stomping, but it's definitely just a guy getting beaten down after his fall and getting stomped on. Just think police brutality and that foot coming down and kicking what I assume is a hobo. I just watched a newbie in chat floundering around with combat. Since you already start out newbies with a cheap pistol equipped, would you consider also starting them with the deck better suited to using it? No, I won't consider that. I'll consider it. I'm considering it right now. No. And two reasons. One of which is actually significant, the other one of which is not, but I will complain about it anyway. The meaningful, significant one, is I don't think that would actually fix the problem. What I need to do at some point is put in a sort of like intro encounter. That, you know, sort of grounds people in the combat system. It's going to be a giant flaming pain in the ass for several reasons, which is why I haven't done it yet. That's going to suck. But anyway, but I think it's important that someone who is starting, someone who does look in the techniques is rewarded with that early and has some different choices that they can make to optimize for that. Whether they go, you know, straight for the shoot people all the time route, or whether they go for, you know, something different like melee or whatever. And yes, I understand that I could just put 5s of those in their deck and leave the techniques out. Yeah, that's fine, whatever. That's not what I'm going to do. The other thing about this that I'm just going to talk about, because it just is I guess, noteworthy for everyone else. I don't think Mag's ever done this, but if you've ever complained about how melee sucks during the Southside quest, or in the early game, if I liked Mag's suggestion, I would not want to take it because the amount of bitching that I receive. Because I'd be, you know, either wiping out or, you know, pretending that melee is substandard. And then, of course, you know, anyone who's a nice person would get the skill or techniques that, you know, obviously are the substandard, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, so anyway. There is an underlying current of usefulness there, which is that... I don't want to completely cut out melee from the early game, because that's fucking retarded. And that's not what you're suggesting, but it comes dangerously close. And if they're... if the game is not approachable if we don't do that, which I said before, I don't think is the case, but if it were not approachable if we didn't do that, I would completely rewrite the early game to assume ranged attacks entirely. And you just kind of get melee later at some point. And just totally change the dynamic of the game. Because, like, a cheap, easy fix like that is not gonna cut it, in my book. So, anyway. Yeah, not interested in doing that. Don't think that it's the problem or the solution. Which is good, because otherwise I'd have to listen to people complain about it anyway. Okay. Moving on. All this eldest business is afraid of propaganda, right? And it looks like the Twisted Hounds are there first. Depends who you listen to. I mean, the face certainly say that they're the eldest. The fish people, who I refer to them, had his deep ones, which is what I almost said. Definitely disagree, although they do not claim to be the eldest. The hounds aren't really talking, so make it that way, you will, I guess. Good luck on the wisdom tooth. I remember when I got mine out 3 at once, my dad decided to cheer me up by taking me out to lunch. Well, it's the thought that counts. It actually went surprisingly well. Still kind of, like, becoming less of a gaping hole in my mouth, but it just kind of numbed me and yanked it out. And, you know, well, I was in the... in the dentist's office, they had, like, the little TV. Normally it's set to, like, you know, morning show awfulness. When I came in, it was to VH1, which inexplicably was showing music videos. Like, I didn't know that anyone still showed music videos, but anyway. But I discovered that they had the Daily Show on rerun on one of the other channels. So I watched the Daily Show, and they anesthetized me and switched over to the Colbert Report, and they actually had, like, the tong things in my mouth to tear the tooth out, which is way less unpleasant than it sounds, because you can't feel anything. At least I couldn't. Wouldn't have been very pleasant if I could have, but, like, as they're reaching in with the tongs, like, you know, watching something that could make me start laughing at any moment, probably not the best idea. Yeah, the whole thing was pretty pleasant. They did actually, when they popped the tooth out, they actually dropped it and it rolled down my shirt, which was, I thought was hilarious. They were kind of mortified for me, which is, yeah, I'm not really the kind of person to take great offense at that. That was me meeting you, so you couldn't hear me coughing. I probably will not go back to edit that out, because I suck at audio editing. And I'm way too used to using these headsets to talk on the phone. A couple questions from Xkiv. Actually, I don't really know, like, I always pronounce it Xkiv. I'm not sure if that's actually how it's supposed to be pronounced. How can we lose data on use? Isn't reusability kind of one of the major points of digital data? I could sort of see it for music and neural recordings, but even then a hacker player could circumvent any pay-for-experience measures easily. But computer code? Maybe there is some point to having multiple versions of code for the same purpose, but losing it? Making a copy should be at most as difficult as decompiling. You know, I've gotten this question, like, I'm going to say, more than enough times. And not that it's been answered before in the podcast, so I just shouldn't feel bad for asking it, but, like, it's a question that gets asked a lot. And the thing that just boggles my mind about this question is not the question itself. It's that, to my memory, and, like, I might be forgetting one, but to my memory, nobody's ever been like, hey, like, there are these books that, like, we use them, and they just fucking vanish, right? Like, you are kind of trained to accept the fact that reading something makes it explode into, like, void, right? But, like, you know, data data is, you know, different and weird. And that's actually kind of half the answer. Most of the data, when you use it, you're done with it, right? It's, you know, the songs that you get, for the most part, are explicitly different songs, or at least, like, variations. Like, you know, you get the Brain Staples, but that's actually, like, a band, right? That's not just, like, one song that you listen to over and over, because that would be really fucking obnoxious. So, like, you listen to it, you're done, you listen to a different song, you know, for 20 energy, which is quite a while, you're done. So, I mean, there's that. It's not really representing the fact that the data vanishes, it's just you're done with it, right? Just like the books, you're done with the book. So it's not gonna, I'm not just gonna leave it rot in your inventory, for the rest of, you know, your reset. And God help us all, I'm not going to try and set it up so that I keep track of, you know, oh, you know, you've used three of these so far, and now you have a fourth one in your inventory. Okay, so you can use another one. It's like, oh, but you, you know, decompiled two of these, so you have two, but you've used three, but you decompiled two, so, like, you can, you should still be able to use one, but there's no chance of how I'm going to track it. That's sort of a related note. That's, I guess, why at a fundamental level, you know, used items go away. Even if, you know, they're not necessarily consumed in a, you know, metaphorical sense. So there's that. And the Neural recordings are kind of similar, although it also burns out the hardware. Which is why you don't get an unformatted memory card. Anyway. The other half of that is more game-centric. The first one is just like, I mean, I hate to say it, but like, I don't really feel that that side is very game-centric. It's really just kind of a, you've used it up. Like, the fact that the data may not be gone doesn't dispute the fact that you've used it up. Okay, anyway. The other half of it is specifically for programming. The way that programming works in the age that Metroplex is in is not the way programming works in the real world. Because programming fucking blows in the real world, right? Like, it's a job. Even when you're working on something that, you know, you really like, you know, Metroplexity, it's not, like, exciting, right? It's not even, like, you know, crafting system level exciting. But the way it works in Metroplex is more along the lines of, I'm not sure if any of you played with, like, the old, I know that they still have, like, the Mindstorms. I don't know how you program them now. They used to have an old, like, thing where you had, like, Legos that you would build the programs out of, like, as a visual tool, not, like, actual physical Legos to build the program out of. But that would be awesome. So, like, you'd have your, you know, make the gears move Lego, and you'd put, like, your if Lego on top of it, right? As a tool there. And that really kind of, is more of how most programming works in the era that they're in. Not a lot is written from scratch. And the people who do write stuff from scratch have kind of boring lives, right? We're talking like people who write drivers for a living, right? Not even someone doing something interesting like Metroplexity. No offense to anyone who writes drivers for a living, but goddamn, that sounds boring. There's a related concept here which kind of ties into both of them that I assume, as part of this being like a dark and dystopian future, I assume that that industry won the digital content wars to a large degree. And that's not the reason that all of the edits go away, but there's sort of a tinge of that. through all this, which extends to those little code modules. Not always. Like, there are some of them that you're getting that are, like, from the sheets of paper and stuff, and you're just typing them in, which has got to be incredibly tedious, but neither here nor there. Okay. Anyway, so there's a little bit of that. Okay, so, but setting all of that aside, right, all of the, like, in-game sort of fiddly stuff, the reason that I will never, ever, ever, ever consider coding in Metroplexity working like coding in real life is because coding in real life is just, okay, decide what you want to do, hit the button that says spend, you know, 20 energy on this. Okay, you have the thing. Like, it may suck, it may be awesome, but, like, that's all the further you've gone with it, right? And that is retarded. Like, that's terrible game design. And as such, I said, fuck the real world, right? That's just not how programming works. In Metroplex. Or in Metroplexy, right? Would be, you know, the city or the game. What you get to do instead of sitting there and, you know, playing your, you know, three chunks of programming a day, you know, working 9 to 5, Hewlett Packard, is just going ahead and making the process of creating the code remotely interesting. By which I mean, you know, gathering those components like any other craft, and using them. And, you know, there's a little, you know, one energy at the end, or a couple of energies as well, just to combine. But, you know, the entire rest of that energy base is, you know, getting chunks of code that it makes you feel better. You can assume that you're on the lookout for chunks of code to work on your next project. But it's a sort of a... I'm losing the word here. A stand-in for actual coding in the way that NetCombat is a stand-in for actual hacking. Because I know too much about both of them, and they're both actually hella boring from a game perspective. Like, I love coding. I really do. But it's not something that I would write a game about, right? And as such, you know, it needs to be a little bit more interesting. And that's kind of where that goes. So, like, either you get, you know, you either kind of have to accept that you're either hunting for specific chunks of code and finding them, you know, kind of as a quest, or you have to accept that, you know, there's really obnoxious DMCA, or something like that, or you have to accept that it's just the way the game fucking works. Because if you don't accept any of those three things, you basically get kicked back to square one of click a button, spend 20 energy, and then, you know, go make a sandwich because, you know, you're not actually playing the game, playing, you know, castles and cubicles. So that's sort of all of the reasoning behind that, which is, I mean, not something that I'm extremely satisfied with, obviously. In a perfect world, you know, I'd probably have some sort of exciting minigame or something, but... Yeah. It's not really, how it plays out. So, I guess, why are data items consumed in general? Because you're done with them. Why are code items consumed in general? We'll assume that you're done with them, but that's, I mean, this is kind of a kludge, to cover up for the fact that I want coding to actually be interesting. And if people really violently disagree, I can make coding terrible, but I'm not feeling it. There will probably be some kind of, you know, code stuff up from scratch at some point. But, I mean, I can't promise that it'll be any more exciting. I mean, one of the other things, I mean, that I couldn't do, with that. And if people really wanted me to, like, this is kind of the other option that actually fits with Metroplex, as opposed to having something like a minigame, which would be awesome, but it's more like, you know, Puzzle Pirates, is either, is having everything work kind of like the language module? Language module? I forget the second one. But the language. The one you have to decompile it. Typically. So, all of them could be quest items, right? And any step, any combination that requires multiple stages of, like, the same item, would end up requiring different quest items. There'd be, like, a bunch of little, not like quests, right, but, like, things like how the language module works. It'd be a tremendous amount of work. I don't honestly think it's worth it. But if people, like, if it really bugs people that much, and it doesn't bug me at all, like, well, that's not true. It bugs me a tiny bit, but it doesn't bug me enough to justify putting any work into it. If it really bugs people that much, I'd go ahead and do that. I'd also consider, like, some kind of, like, self-made quest with, like, a progress bar while you're hacking or something. For coding. But that doesn't really call to me either. But mostly because it, there would have to be some sort of system to choose what the hell you're programming. Like what pieces you're putting in. Anyway, neither here nor there. I think it's fine. But if people really disagree, I can, you know, rewrite coding and hacking from scratch. It just seems kind of wasteful. Okay. Excuse the other question. More beards, more ladies. Where are our bearded ladies? If I recall correctly, I'm too slow. I'm trying to remember the three-ring circus on Spaceball 1. There we go. Took me a second. See, this is why I don't do pop culture references. It's like, you know, that 30-second pause sort of ruins the timing for the bearded lady joke. I guess I could have just gone with, who are you, one of the freaks? But, you know, it doesn't. I've only got, like, you know, 6 voices, and they're all the ones that I use in GMing. I think it's safe to say you probably won't see a bearded lady. Maybe at Halloween. Okay, Bob has a couple questions. Are there any plans for a gang warfare specific unearthly item? Huh. Not particularly. It wouldn't surprise me if I eventually did a, you know, what I said earlier about not hurting very much time, I was just thinking, ignore that. Okay, I'm good now. It's kind of funny, like, it didn't hurt having it, like, you know, yanked out of my jaw, because I was obviously under a ton of anesthetic at the time. Like, they do this a lot now, but, well, not when I was little. They, like, you know, did the swab of the anesthetic, and then, like, so that it wouldn't hurt too much when they jabbed me with the anesthetic. So, like, this two-phase process, which I thought was kind of funny, but which I appreciated, because, like, even with the first stage of anesthetic, jabbing me with the, you know, the needle into my gums, was less than pleasant. Okay, now that I'm done, you know, hurting, are there any plans for a game warfare specific unearthly item? I would say that it's unlikely to have one that's quite that narrow. I would be unsurprised to see something like the plans show up as an unearthly item, by which I mean, like, the target gallery plans, right? You can get stuff like that. So something that, you know, a donation gang furniture. That wouldn't entirely shock me. I'm sure that there are items that will, impact gang warfare in a positive fashion, Actually, there's a couple of things that are in already, not as donation, just as random other undiscovered chunks of the game that I'm kind of curious to see how they'll impact game warfare when they get found. Will we ever see a romantic subplot in Metroplexity? Actually, I think I talked about this a little bit last time, more in relation to the personal sections in your contact list. There's sort of a plus and a minus here. The plus is that I actually wouldn't mind doing it. Like, it's not, like, antithetical to my approach at all. The downside is that I have never tried to write any sort of romance, and most of my, like, writing, storytelling sort of experience is from, you know, tabletop RPGs, where in my campaigns, all of the romance ever has been handled by players, like PC-PC stuff, which is potentially really interesting and, like, makes a ton of sense if you think about it. Like, you know, these, you know, three people are, you know, spending, you know, all of their time together for, like, you know, 2 years. Actually, it was, like, 4 or 5 years game time. You know, how would they, you know, not have, like, something happen, right? And I've just made, you know, all of your tabletop games awkward, but it's the way it is. But yeah, so it's, if it's something that people would be interested in seeing, I would be more than happy to try it out. I know, but yeah, it would be weird. Like, not bad, but, like, weird. It would be a stretch for me, which is why, like, I'm kind of, I would cheerfully try it if people, like, would find any, like, I mean, there's not going to be a lot of, you know, loot or necessarily a ton of, like, quest advancement attached to that sort of subplot, unless you're romancing, you know, Hawk or somebody. Apart from Kingdom of Loathing, what other influences are there for Metroplexity? books, music, games, hard drugs, anything at all? Well, I'm just going to try and answer these one at a time. Books, definitely Lovecraft, by which I guess, like, technically mostly short stories. But there's a lot of, if you've read enough Lovecraft to actually be, like, a Lovecraft fan, rather than, like, you know, like, there's a couple of Lovecraft stories that, like, you're just kind of expected to read. Like, here's your, you know, copy of Call of Cthulhu. Like, if you're a tabletop gamer, it's like, read, must read. But, like, if you actually get your fingers deeper in there, there's a lot of stuff in Metroplexity. There's actually a great chunk, which I don't think anybody's found yet. But it's like, it's like, here's your, you know, at the risk of memeing, you know, we heard you like Lovecraft, so we put a Lovecraft reference in your Lovecraft reference so you can gibber madly while you gibber madly. I'm looking forward to people finding, because there's a lot of neat content attached to it. But that's a newer one. We'll let that sit for a while. Let's see, there's a bits here and there from the Illuminati trilogy, probably. There's, and, like, a little bit from, you know, various dystopian sort of circles. I read, God, Brave New World, in a night, and remember basically none of it consciously. So, like, if you find a Brave New World reference, it's probably, like, infected my subconscious. Let's see. Well, there's a couple of the actual, you know, the quantum mechanics book in games, an actual quantum mechanics book. It's actually really good, like, as far as, you know, QM books go. It's fairly, I mean, the material is fairly opaque on its own, but, like, the for what is essentially a math textbook, it does a good job of keeping things as coherent as they can be, I guess. I think that's all I've got there. Music. I don't really... This is going to sound weird. I don't, identify with a ton of music. Although, I'm not sure if I said this at the beginning of the podcast. I've had... It's All About the Pentiums, Baby, from Weird Al, stuck in my head for, a week. It has been terrible. Normally I get a song stuck in my head, and I, will listen to it, and it'll go away. It went away for, half an hour. And so I'm like, okay, fine. The next day, I'm like, all right, fuck it. If this song is not getting out of my head, I'm going to just chainsaw it out. So I sat down, and I was like, just on YouTube, because I don't actually have a copy of the song. I haven't heard the song for, years before this. It's like, all right, first song, we're gonna watch the music video. Okay. It's like, and then that's what I'd done yesterday, so I knew that I needed to up the ante. It's like, okay. So, I went there and watched every anime music video on there that I could find. There was not actually that many, which is kind of unfortunate. They did have a lame one, though, which was good, but kind of a gimme. It's like, if you can't find good scenes in lane for that song, you're obviously doing something wrong. Serial Experiments Lane. For anyone who doesn't know what I'm talking about, you can search it. It's L-A-I-N. It's an anime about... I think I actually said before that it's an anime that's basically about what would happen if Eclipse affected the net rather than the real world. Or if Eclipse and the net were kind of the same thing. And I think that's a fairly apt description. In general, I don't take a ton of inspiration from music. Which Liz is actually a giant music person. She plays in a early music ensemble, Renaissance and early Baroque. She has a master's in opposition performance. All this stuff. But it actually kind of works out really well, because neither of us, for her, music is something she does, and not really something that she listens to, typically. Very indirectly, I will probably give the occasional nod to Wagner. Not really specifically because of any inspiration, but just because, if you're looking back to Norse mythology from modern times, let alone further in the future, you're going through the lens of Wagner a lot of the time. Which I think is a little unfortunate, because I think the original myths are actually a lot more interesting a lot of the time. I think that just some of the, thought processes that Midgar goes to, handing out code names, are kind of are colored by Wagner's work. They're fine. I still need to actually sit down and get, DVDs from the library for the entire Ring Cycle and watch it some weekend. Games, wow, that's a big one. That's I'm one of those guys who's we've got tabletop RPGs and CRPGs and CCGs and other computer games, which is kind of funny. They're kind of off. And MMORPGs. Shadowrun, big one. One of the main reasons that I designed the setting for Metroplex, but of Metroplex, is that I really love the cyberpunk settings that take up sort of supernatural elements. There's a couple of them, but I think that Shadowrun is the only one that's really done it well. As shown by the fact that even the second edition of it, which maybe this makes me a terrible person or game snob or something, but it's basically fucking unplayable. That it was still worth trying to muddle through because the setting was so good. And I just got their Sixth World Almanac while we were at Gen Con, which is their big setting book, which was fantastic. Couple of really funny editing problems. Like, they had a timeline for every year from, like, God, I want to say, like, 1999 through 2071. So they have, like, a page or two-page spread on each with a little timeline of it. And there are no places where the timelines are repeated, which I just thought was adorable. I don't mean to pick on them for their editing problems. The entire book is fabulous. It does, like, those years, and then the second half of the book is all the countries, just, like, one by one. So not just like the big ones you always hear about, but, like, you know, like, the little ghoul nation in Africa, and, like, you know, what the hell's Australia been up to, stuff like that. And also, like, totally, like, not game-y at all. So if you're just, like, interested in, you know, this sort of setting, you can probably grab it and read it and enjoy it. Although, you know, there's a certain extra amount of joy reading articles about things that happened in, like, old supplements or previous editions of the game that you're familiar with. But I always felt that, like, they'd done that and done it well, and Dark Conspiracy, which I don't think anybody but me has ever heard of, but Dark Conspiracy also did not really a great job, but, like, tried. And it's just a very, like, an untapped vein, which I think is unfortunate. Especially now that we're starting to get, like, you know, the sort of urban fantasy genre picking up steam. I don't think that necessarily extending urban fantasy into the future is what either urban fantasy or cyberpunk needs. But I think that there's some pretty powerful veins to plumb there. But yeah, I just thought it was sad that nobody had, like, gone in and, like, done that again. Because there's so much left there. And, like, Shadowrun took a very, like, traditional fantasy plus cyberpunk approach to thing. And Dark Conspiracy took a traditional cyberpunk plus, like, a kind of creepy Lovecraftian aliens approach to things. And I want to say that there are another one or two of them that I'm just not remembering, but sort of like another jag off there. And let's see, other tabletop RPGs. On the more computery front, there's Planescape Torment, which is sort of the a goal of sorts. There are points in that game, just fabulous if you can still get a hold of it. There are a couple of similarities that are not copied exactly, but, like, there are things that they did that I really liked that I totally stole, I guess. But not, like, super directly. We just kind of ended up doing some of the same things. tracking back a step, one of the things that they did that I really liked is that instead of just leaving their, you know, this is a video game type elements unexplained, they integrated it into the story, which is something I think you can see in Metroplex, Steven, you know, the fact that you actually are basically unkillable, and can regenerate from, you know, anything, is something that, you know, would show up in another game, would just simply be kind of glossed over, and, you know, the general lack of knowledge about your own past, and both of those are also done in Planescape Torment, for very much the same reason, although they end up going a totally different route with it, which is why I want to say, like, we're not copying, so you don't expect to find, like, previous versions of yourself and, like, all sorts of that stuff. Like, we just kind of, we started at the same place and went in different directions. Anyway, the other thing that they did that I think is extremely laudable, that I'm not sure if I even really get there, but there are points in Planescape Torment where you will be offered an option that sometimes it'll just be like, wow, like, I would not have even considered that, like, ever. And it'll just be like, you know, an option in the text dialog. And I at the same time, kind of hope I get there, and I hope that I don't get there. You know, not that I'm conflicted or anything, but I hope that I get there in that. I don't want people to go into, you know, choice encounters or conversations and have it be missing options that they want, typically. Like, there are some things that I've said, you know, fuck it, we can't deal with that right now. Like, you know, a lot of people might want to punch Hal in the face when they get to the top of the abandoned building, which I totally don't blame them. But, you know, just kind of, we can't work that in right now. There will eventually be an option like that. It's just, you know, an entire parallel, you know, path along the main quest line, which I'm not really developing right now. But yeah, like, but at the same time, I don't want to have too many options that neither you nor your character would be like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Maybe, you know, once in a while, like an eclipse encounter or something. Just because that's kind of funny. But, okay, so that's, yeah, Planescape Torment. I mentioned Bane and Kaito sometimes. It was kind of an inspiration for the combat system. They also did, like, the cards with the numbers. Although they went a different direction with it. I'm not really going to say which one I necessarily... I think that they both have their up points and their down points, but I think that ours works better for Metroplexity. But they, instead of requiring, you know, an upward or downward chain, you would basically play them out and get a bonus if you had, you know, pairs or... well, like, all of one kind, or, like, a full house type situation, or if you had a run in one direction or another, you would do, like, an extra, like, 20% damage, whatever, which is pretty cool, but you could just kind of play all of them out. There was no reason to ever not play them, but I think that working it the way that we do makes the chain number of techniques a really strong part of their identity, whereas in Bane and Kaito's, they're just kind of thrown on, and you can even get, like, the same card in different numbers. So, like, you could get, like, a longsword that would be, like, a 3, and a longsword that would be, like, a 7. And it's just, like, not even worth commenting on in the game, really, which is unfortunate. And just, like, my general, like, years and years of tabletop gaming. There's a general theme of... I think that tabletop gaming as an experience... Like, there's a experience of interacting with the world that can be done through tabletop gaming that I think can be brought to a computer RPG. That I don't see often, if at all. And I would like to try and do that. I think that one of the reasons it doesn't often get done is because it's so taxing on art assets, which is the reason, actually, I was originally looking into a very text-heavy art-light sort of game, which is how, like, Kingdom of Lilith kind of got roped in there. So, yeah, it's... It also works well for the sort of, like, well, I mean, one-man band, a lot of sense type thing that I have going on. Although, obviously, I can't do any of the art myself, and we have to depend on Puyo for that. And as far as hard drugs, I wouldn't, like, nothing, like, directly. I don't actually run the hard drugs very much, which is probably kind of funny, like, if you play the game, you're like, oh, really? What? What? This guy's not, like, you know, doing lines of coke off a hooker's ass with the donation money? Like, why am I giving him, you know, $5 a month? What the hell? But, yeah, as, you know, fun as that sounds, I have, like, talked to a lot of people in varying capacities who do, like, like liked to rather extreme use of hard drugs. And so, like, a lot of their experiences kind of come in to Metroplexity. So I had a friend in high school who was talking about, so one of the common effects that you'll get with LSD, or at least one of the common effects he got with LSD, was things will start fractalating. Like, you'll get, like, an object just in your environment that will, like, start, breaking apart and becoming, like, more complex, like, repeating version of itself. Sort of like a kaleidoscope, but way more terrifying. And so he, at one point was wandering around in our hometown, and a, maple, was, you know, it was the fall, and it turned, like, it's sort of like orangey red, and, was fluttering around in the breeze, and he was tripping, and, it started fractalating, and he was, you know, utterly convinced that this tree was on fire, but of course, you know, not being consumed, and, we thought that was a really, really hilarious from, you know, sort of like the accidental, biblical reference sort of angle, would have been, I mean, a tiny bit funnier if it were a bush, but, you know, whatever, bush tree, but also just, like, the sort of feedback loop that develops there, I think is a really interesting, psychological phenomenon, like, how the fact that it looked a little like fire made him start thinking, you know, that it was fire, and thanks to the, I'm not even going to say it's to the hallucinogen, really, thanks to the, you know, magic of the human brain, it started to, you know, be fire. Like, it filled in the blanks as fire. So he saw something strange from the hallucinogen, which led to him expecting something, which, of course, led to him actually seeing that thing, which, you know, fed more into the hallucination, which I think is just fascinating. On a totally unrelated note, there was going to be a giant, when I was doing the earliest design documents, there was going to be a giant Once and Future King reference, which kind of, there was a divergence point with the Dark and Silly, and it was kind of down the silly line, so we haven't gotten there. Might find a way to bring it back in at some point, but not here or there. Enough of my rambling. Hopefully I, both answered the question and gave some more interesting information to people who have listened to all the podcasts, because I think I probably mentioned all of those individually before, but we shall see. From Weird, a few weeks ago, I too have my wisdom twofold. Mostly. Oh, no! Its roots were too strong, so it was a lot harder to pull and had to drill into pieces. So when he pulled it, I could at one point feel it in my nose bone. That sounds like a bad time. So yeah, mine turned out way better than Weird's. Way better. Okay, questions. Did you implement the teeth content finally with the Survivor's Quest? No, although I guess there is some more nomming related content, just in the ghoul sense. Why does completing two of the Survivor's Quest lock you out of the other two if not initiated? I get that they want to hide, but any progress you made and info you gather could still help their cause and be related to your content and leave content open with us for us to... Yeah, no. Yeah. There are kind of two reasons for that. One of them being, oh, God, would that be a giant pain in the ass to program. Like, holy fucking shit, would that be terrible. But the other half of it is, you can finish as many as you want before you talk to hell and say, like, let's, you know, split up. So you can complete all four if you want to. But related to that, the half the reason that you're doing those quests is so that, you can get to know those people, and, like, they can be, you know, the ones that you get to choose. But, yeah, if you don't initiate them, they're not coming back. So, I mean, either initiate them and then talk to Hell, or complete them all and then talk to Hell. Or, you know, just blitz through and talk to Hell, whatever you want. But, yeah, I'm definitely not going to have them stay around as options on your remaining contact, because... And not only would it be a gigantic pain in the ass now, like, not going to do it sheerly based on the time involved, but it also would keep adding complications as I went forward with the rest of the quests forever. So, yeah, not happening. Sorry. Darker Than Black was awesome. Thanks for the recommendation ages ago. Oh, yeah, that is really good. I'm probably not going to rewatch that right now, but I should rewatch that at some point. If there is an unfound way to get top damage buildings without killing anyone, so I can do another pacifism round now that the hideout has been peacefully revamped. Yay! I'm not sure if I said this at the beginning of the podcast, but there are a couple of O4s that you can't get through peacefully now, that I intend to update to allow that in the next couple of days. Like, about the same time Sam is getting the September Unearthly item out. What inspired the hideout revamp? Mostly that there weren't any real, like, meta level choices, going through it. Like, you could choose how to kill them all, but that was really kind of your only option. So, actually, kind of, I mean, Weird's pacifism run that not working, was part of that, and there's some related stuff coming up that I would like to, I mean, I would, the idea of it being possible to go through as, without any combat at all, is something that, I'd like to not encourage exactly, in the sense that sometimes it'll be really fucking hard, and that doesn't bother me at all, really kind of the contrary, but it's something that I would like to be an option for people. Is there a trigger for programmed terror that we're missing? Or just rest a whole bunch? Well, there's a trigger, obviously, but... Excuse me. It's something that'll happen more or less in the long term. You know, in the long term, your chance of getting, you know, program terror approaches one sort of thing. It's not intended to be something that you really grind for, although the fact that people are trying encourages me to hook its unlock to something just completely terrible and obscure so that they can't hurt themselves. Which is just kind of part of my game design philosophy. But I may or may not do that. Also, why is its picture default item.jpg? Question mark doesn't particularly inspire terror to me. Well, it's not... I mean, I could do, like, the creepy eyes or whatever, too, but the, it's just representative of the... the special paranoia that network news gives you being surrounded by threats that are just kind of, like, ambiguous and stupid, but, like... and nevertheless kind of drill into your brain over time. So the question mark is, I mean, like, not to go into, like, some giant symbolic tirade, but the question mark is just kind of representative of the paranoia, really. Like, the idea that there are, you know, bad people, diseases, and so on and so forth around every corner. And if you don't explore absolutely every nook and cranny, they're going to get you. suffice to say, I watched way too much 60 Minutes when I was little. Network news hasn't really improved since then, but it was like, oh, the new disease or the new, like, economic collapse that's going to happen. Not that, you know, we haven't had plenty of economic collapse. It's just, like, the regularity of the terrible things. You know, like, oh, you know, then, like, the terrible things that legitimately happen, like, you know, human trafficking and rape and, you know, murder and drugs and, you know, kids getting, you know, hooked on smack and killing their classmates and taking their shoes or whatever the fuck. But, like, stuff that, like, in the grand scheme of things, it's just like, what the hell? This is tiny, tiny, infinitesimal little, like, statistical blip that they'll spend, 60 minutes, talking about, and then, you know, have Andy Rooney talking about, you know, how you can't actually buy a barrel of oil. Long aside, that's why it's a question mark. It's just the sort of, like, the symbol of the looking for paranoia. Let's see, some questions from Cryptodynamic. Did the concept behind the Twisted Hounds have any inspiration from the Hounds of Tindalos? Yeah, no, definitely. Obviously, like, not a lot of physical similarity, but, I was not saying in the original story that the Hounds of Tindalos appeared in, they were not described the way that they're usually portrayed. But that's neither here nor there. Actually, the kind of a funny story about the Twisted Hands. The original, the art that I got that I used for the Twisted Hands was not originally going to be used for them. It was supposed to be just like a terrible mutant hound with like bone spurs coming out of its skin, which I still need to request art for at some point, but not here nor there. But I ended up getting back, like, you know, the terrible crystal hands that we all know and love, and it was like, oh, hey, alright, sold. But, yeah. Let's see. Oh, but there's a little bit more about the hounds and what they're up to, hidden in various places. With the game's Halloween festivities starting off before too much longer, is there still something from the mummy wrappings that we're missing? You mean other than the fact that they make mummy clothes? Some pants, a shirt, a mask that... There is very nominally something that you're, that's missing, at least from the wiki. I would be kind of surprised if, like, nobody had figured it out, though. But no, the stuff from, I mean, aside from, like, the finicky details of, like, how X works and how they interact and so forth. You know, numbery type stuff. Aside from numbery type stuff, everything's been figured out with the encyclopedia. If I said something different in the giant list of things, when I think it was Meg asked me about, like, every single unearthly item, then assume that I was right then, because I actually researched those. Do our characters actually look long enough to be college students on our parents' dime, or is the student selling books on the quad just not a very good judge of age? I try not to imply too much about the character's appearance for a number of reasons. One of them being that, oh, dear God, do I not want to write different dialogue for, like, different outfits more than I have to, stuff like that. The assumption is that you don't look terrible. Old now. The assumption is sort of like that if you were in, like, Go to TV Tropes and look up Dawson's Creek casting. You're kind of in that age category where you might be kind of a young looking, like, 30s, like my wife's boss, who's, I don't know, 30 something, totally looks my age, which is 29 now because I had my birthday. I think I'm 29, yeah. Mm, yeah. Actually, I'm mistaken for, he got actually mistaken for 28, like a month ago, which tickled his, is not wanting to be old bone, but the, or, you know, you could be an older-looking young person, yeah, like Liz, who wasn't carded until, well, after she turned 21, which is kind of funny. It's like, oh, I'm 16, give me booze, oh, here you go. It's like, oh, I'm 23, give me booze, and they're like, let me see, and not for the reasons that I didn't get carded, which was, you know, growing up in Wisconsin, woo, Oh, but yeah. No, it's, it's sort of a mix of the two answers you have there. You look like you could be young enough, to be a college student, and partially she's not necessarily a great judge of age, and we'll just kind of assume that someone on the campus is a college student, and also a dash of, like, she's kind of got her pitch. And, like, you kind of just kind of use the same pitch over and over. Seems to work for her, though. I mean, she sells a lot of books. Are there any game states? There's all that affect the Royal Air above their location. Active defense, I'm starting to run low on effects. Try, and the equipment hasn't been promising. Well, I think the end question there is, what do you think you have to do for the skill to, you know, be granted? I think that you might have a little bit of insight to that from the original problem you ran into that granted it. But also just, I mean, do you think you have to see all the sites? Do you think there's, you know, actually another terrible puzzle buried underneath that? Of course, you can hear me smiling over the podcast now. You can either guess that I'm, you know, a terrible person and I'm taunting you, or that I'm telling the truth. And it just depends. Do you think the old Mushy would be terribly offended to learn that he's been dubbed Old Man Mushy? He tends to be a pretty agreeable guy. I mean, really, in the file, like you said, he's Old Mushroom Dude. Like, it's, he can't be too offended. Have you thought about adding character titles? Yes. Yeah, I've not, like, been meaning to do that, but it's on the list of things that I wanted people to be able to donate for a long time. Possibly with an unlocking system akin to avatars, and then maybe the option for custom ones to be obtained somehow. This may or not have anything to do with being Lord of the Pearls. This hasn't happened, mostly, not, like, really even because I haven't had time, it just, like, hasn't really jumped out at me. I was meaning, like, way back in the day, to have custom ones through donations, and then, some of them being unlockable. There's another avatar-y unlockable thing, that kind of overwrote that, see a little more of later, but so I guess it kind of got co-opted, which is why I haven't done that, which makes me feel better. I didn't just, like, forget. But yeah, I would still consider doing that. Like, folks would, it'd probably mostly be through donations, probably. I'll think about that some more. But, like, I guess I could put it in that, like, if enough people donate for it to make it worthwhile to implement, like, the title system as a whole, so, like, the custom ones and the unlockable ones, if I decide to have unlockable ones, I would definitely be more than happy to do that. A couple questions from Glass, about Eclipse. Based on the behavior of the Southside Bums alone, I'd assume that Eclipse is an addictive substance. I'm fairly certain that Eclipse is addicting psychologically, but is also physically addictive. Would someone go into withdrawal without Eclipse, and how would the symptoms manifest? I'm going to actually back up a step before I answer this question. I find the general paradigm of psychologically and physically addictive to be kind of weird. Like, and I say this as someone who is, like, terribly addicted to caffeine and has known people that are terribly addicted to, like, other substances that are, you know, actually illegal. And, you know, psychologically addicted, if you want to call it that. I had a heck of a time separating them in my brain just because I think of, I mean, drugs, as we use that term, like illegal drugs, recreational drugs, we'll say, are, you know, predominantly used to affect brain chemistry, right? And then we come back and ask, like, is the addiction that someone feels towards this a psychological effect or a physical effect? Which is to say, like, is this an effect involving, like, the chemicals in their brain or, like, the chemicals in their brain? I don't know. Like, I have a lot of trouble wrapping my head around it, so I'm not going to be a very good person to answer this question. Roughly speaking, Eclipse is, people are often, will quickly grow psychologically dependent on Eclipse. Depending on the effects it's having on that person, it can also be physically addictive. But I would say that the majority of the activity you're seeing is on the brain chemistry side of things rather than on the rest of the body chemistry side of things, if that's helpful at all. People in the game don't seem to have a universal opinion about the effects of Eclipse. Why is it that some people describe being high as Eclipse as a good old time, while others get rendered into bits by nightmarish horrors? What factors affect what you experience when on Eclipse? The amount you took? Location? The type of Eclipse taken? Biochemistry? Something totally occult and mystical? I'm willing to bet you're going to say all of the above. Damn! But can you extrapolate on any of the drugs factors that we don't see within the confines of the game? Yeah, that's a valid question. I mean, there are some things you can probably guess from folks that you've seen, being that, like, people with, what has been called the artistic temperament, will sometimes experience very different effects, than other people. And, you know, some folks experience, you know, very, very mild effects. Some people experience much stronger effects. And as I pointed out in an old thread, PCs are also more than capable of having a pleasant but completely not dangerous experience by just, like, chilling in bed and, like, you know, taking Eclipse and resting 5 times. Not that it will advance any quests or anything, but, like, when you're talking to, you know, the average bum or a college student, that's kind of the speed that they're at. It's sort of like, you know, most people who smoke pot are going to, you know, smoke pot, maybe, you know, play some video games, you know, maybe bake some brownies, whatever. But they're not going to, you know, go gallivanting about, even though, like, they're not going to get busted by Midgard. Not all of them are necessarily aware of that. But I would say that that in and of itself is one of the sort of central mysteries of, I'm not going to really say of this setting. Yeah, sure. We'll say of the setting. But you are, Midgard is also interested in answering that question. And I think you can see the effects of that, of their attempts to answer that. Just throughout the game. But yeah, I would say that there are other effects that you don't necessarily hit on there that are related to Eclipse's effects directly. So yeah. So you need to broaden your net a little bit, as far as the variables that it'll take into effect. There's stuff that is in game that you will be able to see. That also plays into how Eclipse ends up affecting someone. Beyond just the, you know, dosage, location, mixture, biochemistry. And who is taking it. There are some additional factors there as well. One thing that I've always been curious about, never really comes up in the game, but if multiple people take Eclipse within the same vicinity as one another, do they experience the same hallucinations, or do each person in the group experience something different? God, I'm unhelpful. It depends. There is actually a tiny... a nod towards that in the revamped sewer hideout. Where if you're taking Eclipse and you dose one of the guards, you can see what they're seeing. But as a rule, it is shared. Sometimes it isn't, but Eclipse is weird. So it would be, I won't even get into that. As a rule, it's shared. You might run into situations where it isn't, though. Magnifico, or Mag. I always say the full name from the forum, but yeah, Mag. I certainly don't want to preclude Connect from saying more about Eclipse, which is good, because I already totally said more about Eclipse. But if you're interested in this sort of thing, admittedly, I'm not sure if it's very helpful. Glass, you could always... Oh, yeah. There's... Mag was nice enough to link to some of the earlier discussions. Oh, which actually, I think, got resurrected because of that. And it's like, why are these threads being necromanced? But, yeah. Next thing. If some people took Eclipse and thought happy thoughts for a while, could they make a certain place into heaven on Earth? You ask a very interesting question that you may not want asked to certain people. I'm being really unhelpful again. I guess what... I'm pretty sure that people will rue the day where that question is asked to, say, the student body of Metroplex U. That's a dangerous question. And, you know, will it work? Can people sit around and think happy thoughts? Are there other forces at play that may do something terrible? I don't know, but you may not have to take very long to find out. Has Eclipse found its way into other cities, maybe without Midgard planning it to or knowing it has? There's something that I keep wanting to mention about that, buried in the net content. But in very, very limited amounts. Of Eclipse have turned up other places without Midgard knowing. But it's nothing even remotely resembling the scope of what's happening in Metroplex. What are the Twisted Hounds doing in the Mushroom Cavern? They don't really fit in thematically, unless the results of hound drones finding their way in. They fit in better thematically than you know. And they actually, there's some neat stuff going on in there. Thematically, actually, the Twisted Hounds get a free pass to show up anywhere where anything etheric is happening. if it wouldn't look silly, they'd probably have shown up in the Lake Metroplex zones too. But like they show up on the ghost ship, pretty sure, almost positive they show up on the ghost ship. Like I remember writing the encounter. I'm not sure if it got removed for anywhere. So yeah. And they show up like in several different sort of roles in the old asylum during the university quest. So yeah, they kind of have carte blanche as far as that goes. Is Lump Wolf Spores the light of fungal deliverance or a sign that you're doing it wrong? Seem to call that actually is a little more interesting than it looks at first. Let me double check. I wouldn't want to give you a vague hint and find out that nothing actually interesting was going on. Huh. it's pretty awesome. okay, I'm done. Mostly it seems to be a terrible, terrible, terrible side effect of inhaling a bunch of spores. Are there still places you'd rather be born in the world of Metroplex, or have the Scorpionate ever equally miserable? I wouldn't so much say it's a where as a to whom. Because, like, Metroplex itself is really a very kickin' city. If you're born to parents who are, like, middle management or higher in Midgard. And similarly, Japan's totally, totally awesome place to live if either, you know, you or your parents are employees of Zoibatsu. Like, even low-ranking employees. They're a little bit better about that than Midgard is. And, you know, similarly with Omnitech and any other major corporation. Aside from that, like, when you get out of cities, and that's basically what you're talking about, to get away from the corps. When you get out of cities, there are still areas that are, if not completely unspoiled, I mean, there's, global temperatures, UV radiation, all that happy environmental destructive stuff. There are still places that are more or less just, like, I don't want to say unspoiled, but, like, you know, nobody really cares about them very much, so you can grow up there and it's not a big deal. So, like, there are a lot of, like, little towns and so forth that are fine. The big problem with that side of things is actually very specifically related to Midgard, although they probably didn't do it on purpose. They're not quite that snidely whiplash. Sort of agrarian culture that, like, sort of, like, along the lines of, like, the Midwestern United States has, and, like, certain other areas in the world. Like, not, like, subsistence agriculture, but, like, actual, like, growing huge amounts of food to, you know, feed the population of the urban centers, has almost entirely been taken over by drone farming. So you'll have, like, you might have a town out in the middle of nowhere, but it'll basically be a town of a handful of people who, you know, operate the farms, because the owners aren't going to be anywhere to be found. They're going to be rich folks, generally, living in the cities. Or, you know, subsidiaries to Omnitech or Midgard. If they can't make their, you know, loan payments. Or, you know, any number of other, you know. A couple of the sort of Midgard level and just below that, organizations do, corporations, I should say, do farming stuff, because, you know, people still have to eat. Zaibatsu doesn't really have a hand in that at all. They're perfectly content to let non-luxury foods be, you know, created and consumed without having a hand in it. They do a little bit on, like, luxury deliciousness. By which I mean, like, you know, like, fresh fruits and vegetables and so forth. But, so, like, a little town in the wilderness, or, like, in, you know, farmlands, would look more like, it would either be, well, okay, so for every town that you'll see in the wilderness now, in the time the Metropolis existed, you would have seen a lot more and a lot larger towns previously, because very, very, very few people are required to maintain drone farming. When you look at the folks in Southside, a fair number of them are there from the incident as sort of the proximal cause, because, you know, they lived in houses, they, you know, got blown up or enslaved, or, you know, just became so toxic that they can't live there anymore down by where Larry lives, sort of thing. Or simply, like, their workplace was there. They couldn't, you know, afford their house or apartment. They had to resort to, you know, general homelessness and squatting. But a lot of those folks, like, the reason, you know, well, A, they don't leave, and B, the reason a lot of them were there to begin with is just, like, the rural population has really collapsed in the past, you know, couple decades. Like, to, not, like, nothing by any means. Like, people do still have to, you know, be out there maintaining the drones and so forth, and just, you know, generally watching them, make sure that they don't do anything dumb. But one person can do the labor out there now that, like, dozens of people would have done before. So, it's kind of a bad scene. Even outside the cities. You best bet, if you're sort of a independently minded entrepreneur, would actually be, there are some cities, like Metroplex is, for all intents and purposes, owned by Midgard. Like, technically, has its own government, but whatever, like, it doesn't matter at all. And similarly, like, you've got, like, you know, Tokyo and, like, all the prefectures and so forth in Japan are basically just Zaibatsu property. But there are individual cities scattered throughout the world that are not held by one corporation. So, I've been talking a little bit about Hong Kong recently. And, like, Hong Kong, there's, you know, a couple dozen corporations of varying sizes in Hong Kong, and someone who was, you know, more, you know, their own person, or more just like an entrepreneur, or a shadow runner, if you were in, to, you know, borrow a term, would probably find an environment like that a lot more pleasant, but, you know, six of one, half dozen of the other. It might be a little easier to grow up through the cracks between corporations, but for the most part, just the sheer weight of the inequality of, like, distribution of wealth makes living in urban centers kind of shitty. If you're not, you know, on top of the inequality there. I think that's everything that I wanted to, or could really say usefully about that. You're kind of stuck, though, so hey. Alright, some more from Xkip. Login page says you're an enforcer and protector for local businesses. How can I have been doing that long enough for people, Mikael, to know it and have experienced my unique talents, but still start the game so weak that I'm comparatively much stronger at the end of the day? I mean, how come I get more powerful from a day of punches and beating on bums than, presumably, weeks or months than beating on bums? What exactly have I been protecting local businesses from if they still keep me as a protector, despite probably not being able to protect them from a couple of the lowliest lowlifes? I should probably edit that, because there's only one local business, for all intents and purposes. But to answer the general question, it's on the weeks side of things. And it's not a weird accident or anything. You're growing in power fairly quickly. It's just zero is a convenient place to start numerically. If you... I should actually double check and make sure the coding for this still works right. But if you were to actually dig into the code, which I mean you can't obviously, word spade out stuff, you'll find that some of the people that you're running into at that level actually have like negative statistics for that reason. Because they are actually, you know, less badass than you. But the process of, I mean, protecting someone from the lowliest lowlives doesn't necessarily involve shooting the lowliest lowlives in the faces. I mean, you're looking at obviously, like, most people who are defending, you know, businesses aren't doing it to some places shitty as Southside. But, there's a reason that, like, you know, most mall cops are just, like, you know, random bored dudes, right? And, you know, obviously, Southside's far worse, but, a large part of protection on that level is presence. I mean, not everybody will come back after they get shot in the face. So most people, even, you know, people who are okay in general with, you know, the concept of killing somebody else, aren't really going to jump that gun if they don't have to. I mean, if there's, you know, the reason that, you know, the Fangs aren't so much rolling Mikhails normally and are normally just, like, beating up bums, is because they know that they can get away with it, that, like, nobody's going to come protect the bums, really. I mean, but until you start, you know, stepping in and shooting in the faces. It's just a matter of risk. And, you know, targets of opportunity and so forth. But, that said, just back up a step and just, if you think of yourself as having, like, negative fives 2 weeks ago and having zeros now, I guess if I really wanted to, I could say, like, negative, like, 19s, so you have, like, your one hit point. But that's neither here nor there. You have been progressing. Not necessarily at the rate that you get to, like, when you're on the quest, but you have been progressing, and progressing rather rapidly, compared to those around you, because you're starting off from, like, more or less a blank slate, and without, you know, petty, stupid stuff like, you know, memories of your childhood and so forth to slow you down. Tech Runner. So I realize we don't know everything about the new sewer hideout yet, but it seems like you've made this zone quite a bit harder than it used to be. However, the strategic options are as good, resources are very limited at this point. So the zone feels a bit out of place complexity-wise, and even if they're missing something big about it that'll make it much easier for us experienced players, I still feel like it's going to be confusing and brutal. The two enforcers fight is tough with no eyes of the month for newbies. Thoughts? Thought you asked me this in message, but I did actually go through a little bit ago and double-checked some of the encounters against their old versions and got them more entwined there. One of them is actually still a bit harder, but we'll see if that's still a problem. So this has been adjusted a little bit already, and I'm just waiting for more feedback from folks. I've really just heard back about it from you so far, so it might be fixed now, but it might require more tweaking. I just need a bit more data. And yeah, the two enforcer fights were pretty hard. Which metropolitan area would you most like to have sex with? I was reading, posting my, broadcast is tomorrow, little note, and I was like, icy. And it's like, all right, like, that's sort of an interesting, I'm kind of feeling, the Gabe thing with Spider-Man right now. At least I think it's Gabe. Yeah, it's Gabe. So, I guess I'll, if it's a dude. If it's a girl, probably... Dr. Amundsen's kind of a gimme. Student council president, maybe before last Halloween. Not bad. Nobody's really jumping out at me from the female side, which is kind of funny, all things considered. And of course, from the generally gender neutral side, totally the Herald, Herald of Fire. But I guess nominally, kind of could be considered female, but if you're gonna be immolated, you might as well go out in style. From Mag, listen, pal, Secret Society Wars is that way. I actually can do this now that I think about it. For the longest time, I kept being like, oh yeah, I should totally sign up for that game. But I kept, trying to sign up, and I have a Yahoo account as my primary email for a long time. And it's like, we don't accept Yahoo accounts. It's like, oh, well, never mind that. And then, a month later, I'd be like, oh, I should totally... Oh, never mind that. I should know that I have, a bunch of non-Yahoo accounts. I should actually sign up for that and enjoy the infestiousness. I'm kind of curious how much it actually has to do with secret societies, because I must say, I love me some secret societies. But judging by the questions on the character creation forum, I'm thinking maybe not a ton. But I guess I will find out eventually. And Vol is pointing out that hounds show up all sorts of places. Okay, well, that is pretty much it. Let's see, we've got some stuff coming up. We have the September Unearthly Item and the item rotation and seasonal reset boards going in there. And we have some as I stare off into space. We have those going in and Halloween coming up. That'll probably be next big thing. And I hope to make some slight changes that I was talking about to the abandoned buildings for the Slags Quest. Actually, I guess that at the top of the podcast thread, I listed the stuff that I'd be doing. Oh yeah, I'm really looking forward to the beginning of 2011 after Christmas, but. I need to go through the terrible slog of Halloween, which will be hopefully totally mind-blowingly amazing. I'm excited about it, but hopefully that will bleed through properly. Gonna do some stuff in November. We'll see how that turns out. And then sort of the, you know, giant block of Christmas goodness. So yeah, most of the stuff for the rest of the year, so holiday goodies. In the meantime, if you have any questions about the seasonal reset boards or, you know, obviously item rotation or anything like that, feel free to ask. If you have any feedback about the sewer hideout revamp, as far as, like, difficulty or, you know, if anything seems weird, go ahead and ask. I totally understand if people need some more time to, you know, just make sure that they're understanding it and so forth. That's fine. And then, if not, the next podcast will probably be as the Halloween goodies are starting to crop up. We'll probably see little teasers of that towards the beginning of October, and then more like the content getting more solid as the month goes on. Just like little blips at the beginning, so you don't have to take the whole month off or anything. But okay. Well, thanks for listening, and thanks for playing, and have a good one, and I will see you all on the flip side.